Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Yo, what's up, folks?
Brian Brushwood.
Yeah. The man whose name is a sentence.
Brian, you look like you're at a keyboard here, about ready to play us a little something here. You know, you got the kind of like the arm at the right angle, like that.
Yeah,
like,
no. It's like, oh, let me just, I wrote this little ditty when I was renting an RV to go see it in an eclipse. Bling, ding, 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 ding.
That's great, Brian. I guess you never got around to those lessons, did you?
It's four notes long.
So, gentlemen, we talked about this before we started recording Weird Things, and then things went way off the rails there with Brian's sort of interspecies prehistoric romance that just could have gone bad and all the other stuff that happened in that fun show. But I've been very, very fascinated right now about interactive fiction and storytelling and gameplay and a number of other things in that field. So I've been reading tons of choose your own adventure stories. I even have a choose your own style adventure story written by Gary Gygax, by the way, that I found.
Oh, wow. And
creator of D&D. I've been looking into like some of these card game stuff, these novels, these fighting fantasy style novels, reading this sort of stuff. And I said, you know what? I should also take a look at some of the card game stuff that's out there. And I found myself playing Hearthstone for the first time. Don't worry, everybody. I promptly deleted it after doing about a half hour of research on this.
You're the fabled unicorn. You're the guy who just did heroin once and was like, yeah, it was pretty good. It was heroin.
Yeah, it's everything they say it is.
I saw God,
And then I put it later on my iPad, then I pull up my phone and I look and what do I see sitting in the middle of my icons?
Oh, like it installed itself there?
Yeah, I'm like, I wonder how it looks. No, don't.
I'll tell you what, man. In defense, and we've talked about on the show that for you it's a matter of your sanity and your productivity. You can't dabble too deep. You can't go too down. Whatever. You can't trust yourself. But as far as games, you know, Hearthstone is very, very similar to think like the World Series of Poker. It's just you learn the odds and you try to play the other player, and absent being able to look someone in the eye and figure out when they're bluffing and all that, instead you look to the archetype that they're trying to play and you try to outthink what their moves are. Doesn't always work. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. It's a very, very well crafted game, I think.
What I admired about it is that, you know, reductionism is a useful tool in science and analysis, but the danger of reductionism is if you don't know what you're reducing. If you say, well, it's just that. And I get this all the time. Like, I remember I made some comment about really liking, you know, War for the Planet of the Apes, and somebody says, well, you know, it's just The Great Escape, you know, in Spartacus. I'm like, well, you just said it's two things.
Right. Well, and also, how about this? If it was just either one of those, I'd be happy. Those are pretty great things.
And you can play that argument with anything. I'm like, well, what would you consider a great original work? Hamlet? Oh, guess what? Hamlet was actually a reproduction of an earlier play or storyline that we already knew. I mean, like, you can go, it's just, but does it substantially bring something new? And is it a new combination? There's some things that are just derivative in bad ways. And some things like, man, they combined these things before and they added in this other stuff, which made it better. And that can be highly, highly subjective to that. You know, I think Harry Potter is fantastic. There is, you know, the Worst Witch, it's very much like Worst Witch. It's very much like Terry Pratchett, very much like those elements. And you could say, man, this is like somebody read a Terry Pratchett novel and then read some Worst Witch and made something. But Harry Potter turned out great. It's its own thing. It has its own life. Where it's original, it's great.
And I think a lot of times that kind of commentary is really just somebody saying, look, I noticed. I noticed this thing. Like I've made an analysis and I recognize the themes. Look at me, I recognize the themes. And you're like, cool. How about you just say, I recognize the themes instead of saying, yeah, I mean, it's just a Lysistrata meets Clueless.
Yes, exactly. Well, I don't, what do you think it is in people that make them want to do that, make them want to diminish it because they've figured out what it is? Is that a case of like, I finally,
a lot of it's tone. A lot of it's also social cues, that it's always cooler to be the guy who poops on something than it is to be the guy who loves something, because, you know, the arc beyond that is always, well, all right, yeah, I guess it was cool. And everyone's like, yay, you came around, as opposed to you loving something. They're like, yeah, but it sucks. And then you're like, oh, I guess my opinions are garbage then. That's the trajectory from saying you love something. It's just nothing but pain past that. So I think part of it's that. And then other than that, I think that there's just, you know, the identification of something is something far from the creation and from the machinations that it takes to get there. Just because you recognize ingredients in an amazing food dish doesn't mean that you know how to cook it.
Yeah, it's like, I've had spaghetti. It's just butter noodles with sauce. What? You think I wasn't going to figure out you're just taking butter noodles and you're just throwing some tomato sauce on them? Come on.
Why? I ran into, I was at a party and mentioned Game of Thrones, and a woman says, oh, well, you know, I would like it better, but if it wasn't just so derivative of the War of the Roses. What? And I'm like,
War of the Roses.
Well, no, that's the actual thing.
I know, but like, that's a thing that happened in history. Like, not like the book War of the Roses, written by Ted Roses. Like, you know, it did, like, yes, it took a real event in history and it added the Mongol hordes and the Romans and dragons and the elves and undead zombies. But yeah. Other than that, also, than those other editions of real world things.
Also went out of its way to name the Starks and the Lannisters, like it was the McAllisters and the Yorks, like intentionally to let you know, yeah, we're doing the War of the Roses here.
Yeah, and made sure that the Spanish people also had the best wine and they were passionate lovers and like, yes, we get it. But they also added all these other elements to it that were also derivative of history.
Lancaster, not
McAllister. I was about to engage because I'm like, I guess like you could never see a World War II movie because it's like actually a thing that happened. And I just realized it's that I'm not into it. Maybe I don't get it, but I'm gonna say something smart so you don't think I'm dumb. And it was a defense mechanism. It was this sort of, well, I'm gonna say there's some smart thing about this thing so that I'm excused, because I'm like, if you don't want to watch it, you don't have to watch it. And I've made this case for everything. I'll say I love this, and I'll get this like, well, I thought it sucked. I'm like, that's great. Not everything's for everything. You know, everybody. Not everything's for everybody. There are, we've talked about this. Like, I'm like, I don't like things because it's Star Wars. I like things because they have good characters and pull me into it or make me have fun. Plus this other cool stuff.
We have opinions and not everybody likes them. And we have a minority opinion in geek culture, which is that Rogue One was not super great and the best Star Wars movie next to Empire. And those are our minority opinions. Or at least the ones of the twisted mirror universe where we would have such a
opinion. I thought it was amazing. It was the best movie ever. So
ATSD.
So back to like when I was playing Hearthstone, because like I, you know, it's very easy to get into the mechanics. You roll a dice, you have these things, these numbers things. And as a storyteller, I have to step back and go, okay, what's this really about? And I loved the way it played out. I love the idea of the characters and the idea that you take something that's literally a numbers game. It is a numbers game of this number versus number with some unpredictability thrown in there, but you clothe it in, you know, the bosses, you clothe it in the characters you're up against, you add all these other elements, and it's, you know, it's amazing. You know, it's like when you play a game like, I remember, what was it, like Threes, you know, on the iPhone or on the Android, which was this amazing simple number game. But the little sound effects, the little things that happened, the little, you know, it was a weird, that game was hypnotic to me because there's so many things going on to it.
Well, and they also did little things like it would still be a number, but they would add a hint of fangs underneath it and a one sentence backstory. So now it wasn't just the number 16 or whatever. It was a character in this thing, which made it fun as well.
And I would say that this all comes back to is the idea that as lovers of science, we very much like to break things down to its constituent elements, but there is a danger when you break it down and you miss out on that. And that's why I will see movies that I will not. I'll go like, man, I thought this sucked, but I will go watch it again if other people like it. Not so I can have even better arguments of why you're all wrong, so I can kind of understand, because I want to create popular entertainment. You know, I want to be able to appeal to a wide variety of people. And if I can't explain why something is popular other than to say, well, people are dumb, then I'm not a very good popular artist.
I think
I'm not a very good creator.
I think that's what puts you in a unique position that most people – don't pause to consider is that most people as consumers of art, all they have to do is just decide if they like it. And if they don't like it, then they just have to decide why everyone else is dumb. You want to, even if you hate something and it doesn't resonate with you, clearly you can, there's a dollar value to you saying, I don't get it. This did not hit with me, but clearly it's resonating with someone and why. And take a look at what it is that's making it work on there. I think is a very smart thing to do.
I try, Brian. Uh-huh. I try.
Now, what was your takeaway from Hearthstone? You played through the intro, which is something that I think is very, very well polished and certainly pulled me into the game when I first took a look at it. But what did you notice as a storyteller as they guided you through the experience?
Well, I mean from one of the beautiful things, the really clever things about game, really good game design, is the game teaches you as you play it. Like Mario, you know, like the original Mario game, you know, was a game that taught you how to play it as you played it. You didn't have to pull out the manual. You quickly learned what bricks do, what mushrooms do, etc. And when you can do that, that's wonderfully valuable. Same with apps, things like that. Not everything can be like that. And that's often people like, well, if you have to pull out a manual, you failed. It's like, some things are much more complex than other things, and you can't apply that rule to everything. That's silly. You know, you can't – if Dungeons & Dragons, the game, didn't require you to use manuals and other stuff to play it, it would be a very simplistic, probably boring game. And part of the charm of that game is for an audience that likes to read books on how to play this and how to do that, and you have to know where you are. With Hearthstone, in a highly competitive environment that it's in, competing against millions of other games, it knows – we've got to get you pulled into this as quickly as possible. We got to have you understand how to play it. And I will, you know, watching the narrative of you play this as you're doing the single player, playing these bosses to get into it, it's like, we're going to do one. There's the, we'll make it easy for you, make it easy. Then we're going to make it really hard for you and you're going to fail. Then we'll make it not as hard and you're going to learn how to do this. That element alone, I thought, was very massively done. The idea of just taking, I mean, it's a game that it could exist on with dice and paper. Yet it would just be numbers and it wouldn't have nowhere near the charm that it has. We talked about this, about once you personify things, once you anthropomorphize things and you add sound effects, and it becomes much more than what it is. And so, you know, for me, it was just it made me think about, one is, what is the focus of those kinds of games, particularly when it comes to, you know, how I'd apply that to interactive fiction, et cetera. So
was it you, Andrew, that recommended the book Irresistible on the podcast?
I don't think so.
Man, I wonder where I heard that from. The book is called, I guess this will be my pick. I bought it immediately when I heard about it. It's called Irresistible, The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. And they specifically talk about the clever thing about the Super Mario Brothers is how limited it is. You can be handed a control. It teaches you without ever having a tutorial or explanation or anything, because you can only go one direction. So you grab the controller, you try to go left, you can't go left. You realize real quick that you can only go right and that the only other button is to jump. And so you go right and jump, and sooner or later you realize that if you bang a brick, sometimes it breaks, sometimes it reveals a thingy, and then you touch the thingy and you find out what happens on there. But Bryce says past the days of self-taught games.
Games have just gotten between controllers. Like, I guess with touch screens being very simple devices, I think that's a space where something like Hearthstone can be like that. But nowadays, when you're playing games like that where they don't teach you what's happening, it is because they're like Minecraft, where either there's a community and you can go and learn as much as you want, or you can try to suss it out yourself. But on some level nowadays, you've got to be shown everything, because not just attention spans, but like you have to be able to play these games. And some of them are
the only word I strongly disagree with is the nowadays word. Coming from, sure. 1984, you should have seen the 300-page novel manuals that, you take the most copy. Take Minecraft, right? Nothing compared to early editions Flight Simulator. Oh. Sit down and read that
X-Wing,
novel.
Sure. The first version of that. I remember the manuals. Like, it was extremely complex, and it was paper stuff and that. It's like I think the games have become bigger and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But you also have. You come into it with a lot of assumed knowledge you didn't have in the 1980s. We play a first-person shooter, you have a pretty good idea how that works.
But the floor...
Guys, back in their day, they had to read 300-page manuals uphill both ways in negative 10-degree weather, while you millennials play your dream daddy in 5 minutes after downloading.
Well, that's a good point about flight simulators, because they're still around, and you can still get binders of instruction manuals because they're so realistic nowadays. But I'm saying,
fundamentally disagree with the word nowadays again.
I'm saying now, okay.
I guess I'm
trying to get to my point is that the floor has risen.
I disagree. You're indicating that games are becoming more complicated now, and as a result, it's not possible to harken back to the simpler days when you could have a tutorial
to get
started.
What I'm saying is
can I try to split the baby here? I think that we have infinitely more games. So what Ice is saying is true, that there are more complicated games, and that just because the entire pie is expanding, and there is certainly the mainstream as everything splinters and becomes more and more specific, those complicated games probably it can enjoy in a world of infinite choice, maybe more of a dedicated fandom than what the mainstream of gaming would be in the past when there was not as much choice and those manuals were there to literally just explain, to lay down the foundation of knowledge that now just exists for everything. And now we are looking at complications on complications on complications. But on the other end, I agree with you guys that, like, look at the biggest games, the most played games right now are very simple Dragon Point or just like you can play Clash of Clans. Like, you can play Farmville. You can play Plants vs. Zombies or Fruit Ninja in, like, two screens. Here's a fruit. Slice the fruit, idiot. Here's the timer. Boom. Now you're going. More people are playing. I agree with Brian. The floor has not risen, because now you can make the argument that the floor is lower than it ever has been as we create games for multiple languages, multiple platforms of distribution with tinier teams to do it because the barrier of entry. But at the same time, there are more complicated game just because we already have the assumed knowledge and we have a fan base that really wants to dig into them.
Yeah, the one that pops to my mind is, it's been years since I played it, but like Kerbal Space Program, also has a very fairly simple tutorial period, but you actually have to learn, launch vectors and orbital dynamics and I'm sure there are gigantic things. So some of these might be a Rorschach test in that it supports both sides of the argument. Did I misunderstand your take on it, Bryce?
I think so.
Can you phrase it?
Did I mansplain your point?
what I'm trying to get at is that is less acceptable now. Which I think Justin kind of hit upon is that we are so abundant for choice that a game that is harder to get into is going to be can generally be less valuable than compared to when there was a smaller pool of games. And so you have to someone in the chat reminds us of the Super Mario Run game that just came out last year, I think, which is a one button game. It's the phone game. You tap to jump and that's it.
Right,
and that has a tutorial because there are all these extra systems on top of it.
But it's a plain. But I'm going to say that it's yes, it's a tutorial, but it's a plain tutorial. You're playing the game as you play it. You start that, and it's like it just get like you do this, and I would say that it didn't need a tutorial other than the fact that it wanted to go super super mass because it is such an easy. It's an easier game to play than the original Mario. Original Mario needed more instructions than Mario Run.
Sure.
I would say that, it's bigger. There are a lot of super simple games where you can, and you have the convenience of a tutorial too, because back in the day, a lot of times you didn't have the space, you couldn't do that, and you had to do the manuals, you had to do other stuff. I think it's across the board. I think that games, obviously, some games are getting super huge and super complex, and that's the danger. And what I admired back to what we're talking about Hearthstone was I said, okay, I'm not getting a bunch of screens telling me how to play. I'm theoretically playing the game as it's telling me what to do as I move through here. And you could tell these people knew games, they knew attention spans, they knew all this stuff, because I'm like, this is you know, teaching me somewhat complex kind of card game that even halfway through I didn't quite fully get what everything was doing, but by the end of it I had fun all the way through. I never felt like I was in a tutorial.
Yeah. And it's, and that's, you know, Blizzard is fantastic about that, right? When you first start Overwatch, you play as Scout and, or not Scout, that's not what her name is, Tracer.
Yeah.
And they go, here are your abilities and here is how you use them and these are the buttons that you do and here's, and then I think it plops you into that offline room where you can just switch heroes at will. Like, here, like, Blizzard is really good about, like, getting you in and getting you learning. Like, nightmare example that I can think of as like bad tutorializing is Atlus just came out with Persona 5 this year, which is a huge JRPG, 60-70 hours long. And the first 10 or 15 hours you will constantly get stopped and like be very slowly walked through all of these different systems. Here is what you can do on your free time. Here is what you can do at the nighttime. Here is how you use the subway system. Here's how you fight and all these different things.
Here's how you file your taxes. Yeah. Here's how you get into a fight with your mother.
And that's the sort of thing where that is it's easier to teach people inside the game as they're doing it, but it's also, these are incredibly simple concepts that are, you know, very basic to like what a JRPG would be, and it takes away from the experience so much. I've stopped playing it partially because of that, because it's just constantly like hand holding on a certain degree. So it can go both ways.
Well, like, it seems like you should be able to skip that if you're familiar with those regular basics, and it seems like if it's a good tutorial that it would build it in, like, hey, are you familiar with how to move around? Yes, no. And it's like, okay, well, then we can skip that part. Yeah. Or,
I mean, that would be a good way to do it, certainly.
Yeah.
But that's tough because that also ties into it's doing it as you're playing. So there are story beats mixed in. And so I think there is a skip button, but it's like, well, I don't want to miss dialogue because I'm going through this one thing right now. There are a lot of examples of it not being done very well.
So I guess if I'm understanding,
I don't know if we've lost the original thread.
I guess I'm curious. Is your thesis that in general tutorials are insufficient, or they're just done worse, or I guess my question is: do you think we're getting better, or we're getting worse in general with using tutorials to move to guide people into understanding everything?
I mean, it's hard to say better or worse, because you do have things like Mega Man or Super Mario where there are very clear design decisions, and there are plenty of YouTube videos about breaking down how those games are set up to naturally teach you things like that.
Right.
And so I think a lot of that is just being replaced by very upfront direction. But I think that there is plenty of over tutorializing as well.
It just seems like the answer is everything. I mean, the barrier for entry has never been lower. The amount and quality that is being created by fewer and fewer people has that ratio, I don't think, has ever been bigger. And that goes even beyond video games to board game and card games. You know, like right now we are seeing a renaissance on both ends of the spectrum. My buddy at Daily Dot, Josh Rubin, literally just sent me a picture of a new game where you just match. It's a match game for dicks. Like, you literally just have to match. Like, it's about as simple as you could possibly do, but it's from a brand called Drunk Stone and Stupid, or the creators of that game, that is very simple. It is as base and as uncomplicated as you can possibly get, and they are very popular. And on the other end, I'm going to go to Gen Con, where unless you read a 14-page double-sided a 4-point font manual in the original Dutch, you cannot play this game that takes a minimum 7 years where you are all living in a dormitory. And those are the only true games, are those for which have all these complicated rules. And both of them are doing great financially. And the ability to print them has never been easier. So more and more people are doing them and steering into those curves. Just as much there will be a uncomplicated version of the dick matching game, there will be a more complicated version of the spend 7 years in a dormitory game and learn Dutch to play it. Like, and I think that that's even more so in video games, where really all you need is just a bunch of programmers and throw it up on Steam. You don't got to worry about reordering. You don't got to worry about stocking. You don't got to worry about selling or shipping. So I would say everything. It's all, you can probably find great examples of tutorials that are far more garbage and ones that are now more streamlined than ever, just because everything, the rule is more everything.
You know, what's interesting too is, like, in that story, you and Bryce touched upon this earlier about where you come into something. Like, you know, Minecraft had Minecraft communities and people like started from one community and Notch, hey, let's try this thing, and a very neat business model, and expanded into this amazing franchise empire. And then you talk about Gen Con, which was founded almost 50 years ago next year by Gary Gygax. And yep. That came out of the whole wargaming community, where you had these war manuals and stuff. And the whole evolution of why we use a 20-sided die is kind of curious too. But, and these were people that wanted these rules, and they wanted things that were, and they would release rules updates to Dungeons and Dragons, to other games, like OS updates. You know, we've got this, you know, like Dungeons and Dragons, we're on like number 5 or 6 for which manual or whatever this 5. Yeah.
Yeah.
4 was this, you know, a lot of people weren't happy or whatever, but like, you know, you get this sort of this interesting, the complexity of it's part of it. Games like Dwarf Fortress, which is this obscure sort of like was mostly a text-based thing, which is this, you know, about the nerdiest thing I've ever heard of, but it's fascinating. And it's like, you know, either I want to write that book or Neal Stephenson will, and he'll write the really good one that I'll want to read, you know, about, you know, that kind of immersive sort of world of that. But, you know, it is knowing where things come from. What was fascinating to me about Hearthstone, and this was a thing that I thought was kind of really interesting, is that up until that point, I mean, there have been a ton of card-based games that have just been totally phone-based or mobile-based or whatever. But card-based games initially with Magic the Gathering and Pokemon were based upon the idea of, part of the value of the game was the cards themselves. These cards had value. That was the economics of it. And you get into Hearthstone, which I could see how another big company wouldn't consider doing that, because it'd be like, no, it's, you got to have the cards you buy. That's the real value, whatever. But Blizzard, you know, Blizzard saw, well, no, we think there's another, we think the gameplay is fine. We can just change the economic model of it.
Yeah, because you can't really buy or trade. You can't trade cards.
Correct.
In Hearthstone, right? You have to buy them in packs, or you get the expansion packs, or you get dust to craft cards.
To craft the cards, yeah.
Yeah.
And enough, you know, there's enough value. If what you care about is functionality, then, you know, then you can just say, well, every time I get a gold card, I'm just going to dust it, because that'll be worth something to give me something functional elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Did you guys see Hearthstone player Trump made it to Legend on a totally free to play account? He opened up a brand new account, never paid a single bit of money for anything, built a deck, made it all the way to Legend on it.
Yeah, one of the designers, Yang Wu, I think, did the exact same thing. That's possible. You know, you just need to know what the cheap decks are and how to play them, and it helps to be good. It helps to you know, be able to play the game in a way that works. But I mean, it shows you that the game is good, right? You know, that you can actually do it. I it was funny. I was talking to a friend of mine who dead_flip on Twitch. He does pinball streaming, and he was talking to me. He is like a training descendant of the guy that basically won the court case that brought pinball gaming out of the realm of gambling.
Oh, and yeah, and this story is phenomenal. The claim was these are games of chance and they are being used to gamble illegally. And so they said, no, it's a game of skill. And to prove it, we got this guy who's going to come in and just keep winning over and over and over again. And he did. And it swayed the case. It proved it in a New York court of law. And it said, okay, this is a game of skill.
And the funny thing was, in some places, it was being used as a game of chance because you got scores that illicitly, and that was, part of the whole. But yeah, the history of gaming is amazing. I did do a brief mention of it in one of my Chronological Man books about the origins of pinball and whatnot, and it even gets murkier back because you get back to the point where before they had the flippers and stuff.
There's a pinball museum in Alameda where you see the early pinball things and you're like, okay, this is just a fleece machine. This is just like a permanent carnival where you are just playing. It's Plinko effectively where, you're like, oh, okay, I guess I lost my money with this like totally super slim margin of how I'm going to do stuff. But yeah, the modern pinball machine is certainly something that, is a skill.
There was, when I was a kid in Norway, 12 or 13 years old, they had these essentially exactly those. The way you would play, picture a Plinko kind of setup. There's some with, 10 kroner payouts or whatever. But there was no mechanical flippers or anything. Instead, what you did is there was a slot with a little notch that you set your coin on, and then with your index finger, You just tap the coin in from the side, and how hard you did it depended on where it landed. And there were people. I saw it with my own eyes. I don't see any reason that it wouldn't be possible to be skilled at it, because there are people who just take, that was the other thing, is you could choose different denominations. You decided what size kroner to put in. I may be misremembering at this point, but basically you just tap it in and you could get it right down in one of those slots and just keep paying out. In theory.
Yeah.
And, pinball is a great example of, it's a game that, like, okay, I'm watching a ball slide down a plane. Like, well, that's too reductionist. The sound effects, the feedback, all those other little things that come in there, and you get into, you could draw a line by why is pinball successful to why was Flappy Bird successful. And Flappy Bird first. The pipes, they're going to look like Mario pipes. So you're going to get a little bit of a little nostalgia buzz when you see that, We're going to create this little intermittent feedback and this little anthropomorphized, cartoony looking bird. And I think a lot of Flappy Bird was fluke. Let me make that very, very clear. But it's you have to have certain elements there for the fluke to work. You can't take a completely crap thing and have it succeed. There has to be something to it. And, there's been, and you hear people talk about like game designers, like, oh, we tried 15 different games to figure out what made something work. And, it's just random. I think, yes. And, I'm in the middle of listening to the audiobook Hitmakers, which I find 70% of it I really enjoy. 30% of it's sort of aggravating because I think the writer does a really good job, but sometimes he stops short when he finds the narrative that suits what he wants to. He describes things go viral, but they don't really go viral because that's not how a virus works. It's like, no, actually, a virus does work in that same way. If you don't mention influencers or vectors when you're talking about virality, then you're missing what those things do. But it's still a very compelling book. Mm-hmm. And, trying to break down why do some things become popular and some things don't. And there's not enough room for everything to be popular, but you want to make sure that you hit a certain number of things.
I'm going to buy it right now. I'm taking your advice.
Yeah. And again, we'll have a discussion about that because I think parts of the stories are really good, but then part of it, I'm like, okay, he talks about like, whoa, sometimes we don't know why these things, become popular, and it's because of what we call dark broadcasters. It turns out that somebody on this, Justin Bieber tweeted this out. And I'm like, yeah, there's a word. We use it called influencer. There's nothing dark about that. When somebody has that wide of range, exposes it, it's the same. It's almost sort of this Manhattan view of things, of it's not a real phenomena. It's not important until it happens there. And, it's this podcasting didn't become real until apparently Serial, and you're like, wow, it's been a big, huge, thriving thing with mainstream people like Adam Carolla and Kevin Smith and other people who've been doing entertaining millions of people, greater cumulative audiences than Serial. And Serial is great, not taking anything away from it. It was already a big thing, but once it broke into your little environment, now you've decided that it's real. You know,
well, yeah. And I think it's just a case where like nobody's got the full story. And so I'm willing to give in this case the benefit of the doubt that it's like that's the story as best you can see it. You know, whoever you is writing the story.
Oh, for sure. But I guess that I'm going to, you know, what I liked about the show Ozark is that's a big place. You know, my mom's in the Midwest. I'm talking to my mom about her going to Ozark. And, you know, more people go to the Ozarks to vacation than go to the Jersey Shore.
Yeah.
But you know, you wouldn't know that because it's not on a coast. And that sort of mentality of it's not real until it's in front of me. And I would say that our last election was very much like, hey, yeah, no, there's a lot of things going on. And if it's only important to you when it makes it through your individual bubble, then you're missing the bigger story.
Yeah.
So
it's like a total black swan. Nobody could have seen it coming except for a lot of people were able to see it coming.
Yeah, and there's some neat examples in Hitmakers which talks about how, you know, a recording executive will listen to see how well they'll use Shazam, one of the sound, you know, the sound apps that listens to see when people see what song's playing. They focus on some small town in the middle of Texas. Mm-hmm. Because if they play a song there and they start seeing that it starts ranking really high there, they know, oh, this will play bigger and bigger cities. And so it's a very good example of like, yeah, you gotta look outside of the major markets and look at the rest of the world, so to speak, which movies, entertainment too. That's one of the things too, is that I'm myopic about that. I think about like, you know, I think of entertainment, I think about America, but you know, we're in a point now where the app market in China is bigger than the app market in the United States.
Yeah.
Yep. You know. I mean, why do you think there's no more VPNs on the App Store? That's a lot of people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's, ooh. And then, you know, you get into thinking about gameplay too, like how the Android ecosystem is different than the iPhone ecosystem. You know, I have this sort of iPhone centric thing of playing it, but a hell of a lot of people out there, more people with Android, you know, but, you know, I might make the argument like, well, put that economic model slightly different too. So, anyhow, we see what's in front of us.
All right. Can we talk about the elephant in the room? How great was Pickle Rick last night? That was a good episode of Rick and Morty.
Didn't watch it yet.
I haven't seen it yet.
Okay. All right. Well, there's Pickle Rick. I just ruined it for you.
Yeah.
Was this the one that aired over the summer, or is there more to it?
No. The one that aired over the summer was the first episode. They're now on the third episode. They've been teasing it in the trailer. And when you look at it, I'm like, oh, Pickle Rick. I'm sure, you know, just like Tiny Rick, that's what everyone's going to shout. But instead, it just was one of the most creative writing exercises I've ever seen.
All right, next week.
All right.
Everybody see Game of Thrones?
The writing's so good. That last episode, I was like halfway through it. I'm like, is this And then it got to the end, and I was just like, God damn it. They're just so good. It's just such a well-written show.
Yeah.
Yeah. They know where you're going, and then they're going to be there waving at you and then pointing you in a different direction.
Yeah.
So, Game of Thrones.
Great. Highly recommended. We talked about it in the break in the pre-show, but it's like I just spent so much of it, just so thankful for what an amazing journey it's been. And even as it's coming to an end, and we got time here, but still just loving every minute.
I still don't really have a sense of where anything is geographically anymore because everything has been so condensed for this season. But oh my God, is it so? It's just so amazing. Business Insider or Tech Insider, their Facebook page or whatever, has been putting up these a catalog of callbacks from previous episodes, and it's pretty cool. There's a lot of kind of like cohesion to this season that I think is remarkable. It's such an amazing, sprawling story. That acting's so good. We're so emotionally invested in so much that like even in a season like this where every episode has four or five moments that you've been building to forever. I mean, look, that's an episode where theoretically the absolute mirror paths, one of bravery and honesty to the point of death and resurrection, Jon Snow finally comes back into the orbit of Theon's, which is the opposite, one of cowardice and bravery and cowardice and incompetence that has somehow continued to survive, and now they're back in the same thing, and it's like, well, crap, we got to give them a moment, but like also, we're doing a lot here. We kind of already did a sibling reuniting like 5 minutes ago, and we're about to get into this other thing that also has a complicated sibling element to it. Like, so let's just have them yell at each other real quick, and then let's get to it. But it's not, you don't feel cheated because it was a great moment. It's just like, man, there's a lot happening.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know, you know, much as Hearthstone is brilliant because it tries to do less than Magic the Gathering. I think the TV show might be brilliant because it tries to tell less of the story than the books and to the right tune.
And even now, they're speed running that story.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about, like, it's been brought up before about how compressed things are and what's in, you know, that you know, Westeros is supposed to be like the size of South America. And I think that one of the things that's hard to do when you're doing any kind of visual storytelling is to convey a sense of time, you know, because, you know, if you want to show, you know, do we, and I assume when we watched the episode last night, months passed from the first part of that episode to the end of the episode, you know, that it wasn't like, and it can feel like next day, you know, here they are and, you know, here's the army attacking. And that's, I'm like, what do you do? Do you give Tyrion a beard, you know, that grows longer and like, man, you know, that voyage across the sea, you know, glad we make it. All those amazing adventures we had there, you know, it's challenging. And I'm glad that everybody's kind of on board with, okay, it's compressed. But I have seen some critics go like, oh, what, you know, they have time travel. I'm like, no, like time, it still takes time. It's just that they're not spending a lot of time telling us how much time it's taking to get around the place.
Right.
One question. So, before the big attack, Field of Fire 2, the Dragoning, were they outside of King's Landing? Had they just gotten the gold to King's Landing, or had they stored it at another castle on the road to King's Landing?
No, I thought they were just outside of Highgarden, because they very specifically said that it was important that Daenerys not storm the Red Keep, not come in and be just another bloodthirsty monarch that comes in, and so instead she went and attacked out there.
So they were still, but they were on the road from Highgarden before, and then
I thought he said we got the gold to King's Landing at the very beginning. I thought they said we got it too.
Well, then that seems like a counterintuitive message that they would make such a big moment of don't be like everyone else and attacks King the Red Keep and then immediately attack what just outside of the Red Keep.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't assume that. I mean, I assumed that they maybe sent that carriage cart way ahead. So I was not clear on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the only thing I was unclear on, because I assumed that like anytime that we spend that amount of time with, you know, a big cart full of gold, you assume that cart full of gold is at some point going to come in peril from somebody.
Yeah. That's my assumption too. Yeah.
And so I didn't know whether or not he had said that, like, oh, we got it into King's Landing. And as soon as he said that, I'm like, all right, y'all are in trouble. Otherwise, the camera shouldn't be on you.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah. Do we got picks? I'll make my picks. That book that I just told you that I'm going to have to look up the title again.
Irresistible. From Adam Alter.
Yeah, from Adam Alter.
There's no telling where the money went.
There's some parts about it. I think it unfairly it does that thing that a lot of people do, where they'll describe a thing, and they'll never justify it, and they'll never offer any evidence to support it. They'll just act like, and obviously that's terrible. And I really question that. I think it's possible for us to be super addicted to our technology, and also that to be the destiny of humanity as we become more and more Borg-like. And that could be just fine in my book, but he doesn't seem to think it's fine.
I really like Timothy Wu's Attention Merchants, because it did not cross that line. I mean, it said, yes, it is distressing how much our attention's being merchandised. It's distressing what this is happening, whatever. But I didn't feel like it made Google or Facebook out to be mustache-twirling villains. You know, it's like, this is the evolution of where we are. As I mentioned this, then somebody said, oh, you should check out this other book. It's a great companion. And it was just a philosophical screed about, like, you know, this anti-consumerism kind of. I'm like, no. I said, the brilliance of Attention Merchants for me was it seemed very objective about it. And it wasn't doing, you know, therefore, this is all evil. Like, I've made my stance on Facebook very clear. You know, it's not for me, but I want to live in a world where people can make that choice.
Tim Wu also did a masterful job of that on the Master Switch as well, because you can. It's a bit of a canvas that you can project a keep the government's hands off of telecommunications message, or a we need laws protecting net neutrality yesterday. Type of thing. I think Tim Wu might be one of my favorite authors these days. It's really
cool. Hey, I got it. I want to read that next. I get frustrated because, like, what was it like? There was another book that came recommended in my feed, and it was this highly recommended, and it was this super anti, like, you know, Google, you know, Google's ruined the thing for creative artists and all that. They've totally destroyed the market for this and blah, blah, blah. And therefore, we should regulate this kind of stuff. And I'm like, if you think that solution's going to make it better for artists, you're flat out wrong. You know, we have, believe it or not, we have the best environment you can imagine right now for artists across the board. And yes, not every art is going to make you a living. You're not everybody's going to get a living like this. This was always the case. But as a percentage of the population engaged in the arts today versus 50, 60 or any other country, you know, not to say, oh, it's perfect or whatever. It's not. And, you know, I just... You know, I get frustrated with that kind of thing. It's like, yeah, I've watched my business being entirely disrupted by the internet. I watched my magic videos be, you know, YouTube gleefully distributing these things and trying to do takedown notice after takedown notice, which I think was wrong of them. I think that YouTube should have had a better system. I think they should have been penalized more. But the people who are in the position to do that figured, you know what, as long as our stuff is protected, we don't care.
Yeah.
But that being said, I'd rather live in this world than the alternative.
Yeah.
So.
That was one of the most formative moments of my young life, was watching the documentary This Film Is Not Yet Rated as a youth, all full of piss and vinegar about loving movies and reading all the movie blogs and everything and being like, oh my God, can you believe the MPAA? What a piece of garbage, you know, like just ruining movies and giving them these things and they're ruining their business. And then that first half of that documentary is great in explaining what the MPAA was and explaining how the MPAA came to be. And then when it turns to the, like, yeah, and it sucks so bad, because I'm like, yeah, it sucks. It sucks. And then it's like, it sucks so bad that the government should regulate it. It's like, whoa.
What?
Yeah.
Wait, really? Like, I'm all cool, like, pointing out, you know, that the MPAA is too secretive and maybe too, restrictive in what they allow. And yes, they probably censor sex too much compared to violence, if you want to look at those things. And maybe we can even rethink about how we do things so it's not just a simplistic R rating. But if you think that the solution, it made a hero out of Jack Valenti, the guy who created the MPAA, to me, because if you look at it now, oh my God, my favorite indie movie got an NC-17 instead of an R because there was a lesbian kiss, you're like, boo, you suck. But if you look at it like, hey, he saved the American movie industry from government regulation by creating a possibly too conservative independent board, like, he's a hero.
Yeah.
And the people who run, who had the biggest control in that documentary, well, it's the theater owners. So the people who are at the end of the line right before the customer, who are making the choice of what they want to show in their theaters, come up with this rating. Like, well, if they give you bad rating, then it comes to shown. Yeah, they're deciding what they want to show or not. And guess what? Home video totally disrupted that market. And we said, you know what? We want alternatives. If the alternative model is these people own these big theaters, guess what? We have it. It's home video and indie. And I don't know if you heard, but home video is doing really effing well while the theater industry was declining. Worked out pretty well.
That moment near the end of This Film Is Not Yet Rated, where it's like, and now we're going to publish the home addresses of all the individual allegedly secret people who work for the MPAA. And it was like, it got pretty tacky.
That was gross.
Yeah.
It was gross.
Like, yes, root for the good guys who are literally rooting through the trash of private citizens. Yes, you know, like just a regular good guy. Hey, speaking of complicated protagonists, my pick is Master of None Season 2. I finished it last night. It is a very, very well-made but frustrating season for me, just in that I can deal with all of Aziz Ansari's wish fulfillment. I can deal with the indulgences of what he wants to make, but like, man, when I'm into the story, I really wanted to be into the story, and the show, to my counting, has at least three sort of bottle episodes where they just go follow other people that are either ancillary to the main story or just absolute, totally random people in general. They're just telling slice of life stories in New York. And, you know, in a show where you're trying to get 20 episodes, I can take a bottle episode here and again, right? You want to move things along at a certain pace. But when you're a 10-episode Netflix series and I'm really invested in what had happened in the first season, man, it was really frustrating, no matter how artistically satisfying those side jags were, to just constantly be pulled away from the thing I wanted to see develop.
So thumbs up, or?
If you like the first season, the second season's worth it. If you enjoy Aziz Ansari's comedy, it's very much worth it. And if you enjoy food porn and Italian cinema, then it's certainly worth it. I was very happy that I took an Italian cinema class in college and I could get all the Antonioni references.
Well, 2 out of 3 is not bad. Maybe I'll check it out.
My pick is a science fiction story, classic science fiction story by scientist astronomer Fred Hoyle, who had an amazing career as a scientist, brilliant, was very right about a number of things, very wrong on some other stuff, but was an incredible thinker who dabbled in, he was the guy who came up with nuclear synthesis, which is the idea that everything we're made of was formed inside a star, so he came up with the whole idea of star stuff. Not into Big Bang Theory, had some radical ideas about evolution, was into panspermia, et cetera. But he wrote a number of books, one of which I would recommend, and we're at the 60th anniversary of, which is The Black Cloud. And it is very hard sci-fi. It's a bunch of guys in an English country estate for most of the book debating about this big phenomenon as this small smudge becomes bigger and it's a black cloud sweeps into the solar system, blocking out the sun. And so it's hard sci-fi, and it gets into, you know, what this is and what's going on. I don't want to spoil anything for you because I liked going into it not knowing what was going on other than that phenomenon. So it's very dry, and the lead character feels like it's a sock puppet for himself because he's really smart, almost always right, and he's concocted this plan of like, I mean, it's like as the world's going through this disaster, they've decided they're going to take over telecommunications so the scientists can run everything at last. You know, which is like, this is why I love science, but I hate when scientists get political because they're incredibly naive. And you see that there. But it's still a fun, dry, hard sci-fi book.
Yeah.
Nice. That's my response, you know. I'm reminded of an Elon Musk quote where he was talking about like, you know, the idea of when people talk about, well, people, you know, if you're either for people or you have to ask a question, then why bother having people? You know, and he's like, I like people. And so I like the idea of having people. It sort of relates. But anyhow,
awesome.
It's if any of you ever read it, there's a fun discussion to have on this book because it is this, there's an arrogance there that is just this, an unaware arrogance in it, but it still is a science. It's really a fun read. So that's my pick.
Very cool.
Gentlemen, it's been after.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.